some means of detecting that signals. Now everything is done by the computer, and everything is available. So locking the software-based receiver to the VLF, MSK station, or GPS reference signal ensures great frequency accuracy and stability. Accuracy. I have a problem with the accent. Accuracy, right? Okay. So this, there are the essential requirements when looking for very long duration and the weak signals birthed in the noise. Bandwidth may be measured in, listen carefully, microhertz. So it is vital to know precisely what the station is transmitting to the fraction of the hertz. The image about, there is an image that I have in my computer that shows that the VLF water flow, and it's simply, as I say, a work of 2 days when you actually know everything about it, and then you have a working station. So let me go further. We have another interesting way of receiving and transmitting signals. And that is ground. So you could actually connect your antenna to the rack, and then through the air you are able to send the signals and receive it from the other side. This is nothing new. In 1840, we have Samuel Morse, the Morse code, we know. He was working on such transmitters and receivers, and he was the one of the first who used the ERF mode. Then in World War I, there was a plant of station using it, and we have a military application where thousands of those devices were built in 1960s. The communication was provided between nuclear station installations. More recently, they have used extensive ELF rays to communicate with submarines. But for our purpose, we don't have to have such a big antennas, and we can still transmit and receive. Amateurs started to use it around 1920, and there was some interest in USA in World War II years when more conventional radio transmissions were stopped because of the wartime restrictions. ERF mode was converted frequency in QST in 1940 war years. In the mid-1960s, the Practical Wireless ran a couple articles about the ground communication, and a lot of interest was created at that time. We had amateur G0AKN who had tried ERF mode, and that was the frequency at 136 kHz. So we're not talking about very low frequencies. We may use ERF mode also in higher frequencies.
Wesley?
Yes.
I just want to kind of put a little bit of a focus on this. You do realize the reason why the Navy basically said, yeah, sure, use these frequencies. We don't want them anymore?
No, I would love to hear from you.
Okay. As you mentioned, the bandwidth is very, very, very narrow. The bandwidth is related to the symbol rate. In other words, you put out a lot of information in a single sideband transmission that has an approximate 3,000 cycle bandwidth. You put in less information at a given rate for CW, where you're only transmitting a code at say, 20 words per minute. If you increase the speed of your CW, you actually produce sidebands that widen the bandwidth of the CW. The big problem with very low frequencies, although it's a fascinating spectrum, is that it has a negligible symbol rate. You can barely transmit anything useful in the way of information to anyone unless you have a few days to do it.
There is yes and no. We have digital communication right now, so that what couldn't be done in the early days of low frequency radios now is being done the way of digitizing the information and sending this information. And that depends which frequency do we use. The lower frequency, the less we can send in this given time frame. But if we use the frequency of 170 kilohertz or 160 kilohertz, we need to remember that just twice of that frequency we have commercial radio stations working in AM and to AGM.
200 kilocycle AM broadcasting radio? I'm not familiar with that band. The problem is that digital compression and such might do a little bit of something, although not really that much. I mean, if anything, unfortunately, Joe Taylor's algorithms slow down the symbol rate even more because they add layers of redundancy and correction coding. So they don't increase symbol rate, they decrease symbol rate. So you're stuck with the same thing. And the problem was that the submarines, it was the only thing that they had to go with, so they went with it. But they were only able to transmit very, very, very short information packets. Nowadays, they just bounce off satellites at much higher bandwidths and frequencies. And so the symbol rate is incredibly better these days, and that's why they finally said you can play with the low frequencies. So it's an interesting technological aspect. Its practicality is very dubious, again, because the symbol rate is inherently incredibly low.
We're talking about from 1 to 1 hertz to 1 kilohertz. I would agree with you. When the higher we go, the more information we can send. And if you just take your software defined radio and tune to a frequency of 70 hertz, somewhere over there you're gonna hear harmonics of AM radio broadcast stations. So now you have proved that 70 kilohertz, you can have a full freedom of transmitting a lot of information. Do you agree with that?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John, please.
Well, I was just thinking about WWVB. At 60 kilohertz, they're only managing a couple of bits per second just to be able to get the time to set these so-called atomic clocks. That's at 60 kilohertz, so they're just managing really a couple of bits per second. Go ahead.
Thank you, John. I would agree with you. As I mentioned before, AM broadcast, at least my awareness, pretty much starts at 500,000 cycles per second. So when you get down to the loafer range, again, it was primarily the Navy loved it because it was something that they could send for incredible distances while they were submerged, and it worked, but it gives you a terrible symbol rate, and the laws of physics don't let you get around it. Even the brilliance of Joe Taylor, Nobel Prize laureate, can't do much. He can improve your ability to receive the low symbol rate signals, and you can receive carriers, and as you mentioned, you can receive the mixed results of broadcast stations producing lower carriers. But the carriers have a very limited ability to transfer information, which is what we kind of want to use radio waves for.
Okay. I was stopping for a moment with you. Well, as I say, any one of you can go to 70 kilohertz. And from 70 kilohertz up, you can hear plenty of radio stations, and they're harmonics. And you can listen to the music and to what they're talking about with no problem. I did it in the past many times.
At what frequency are we talking about?
70 kilohertz up.
Okay, I don't know how you do that because the bandwidth available is kind of limited, so it doesn't give you a heck of a lot of audio bandwidth to be able to manipulate.
Well, you can listen to those stations. Of course, the quality is not great, but you can understand what they're talking about. But if I go a little bit further to the Earth mode, I would like to say a few words before we go to the space report, how the transmitter and the receiver is made.
Okay, Wes, but just keep in mind that Paul's waiting, so, you know, brevity is the soul of wit.
So the Earth mode means communication between TX and RX, which is the transmitter and the receiver, primarily through the conducting medium such as soil, rock, and water. And here I a little bit disagree with that, what I'm reading right now. V11 ULF signals are injected between the two Earth rods on an Earth rod and water pipe, setting up the current flow between them. Current will flow in an infinite number of paths between the two points because the medium has resistance. At the distance Rx, a couple of electrodes may be inserted, and the weak potential difference between those is detected. Signal dose propagated attenuate rapidly with distance in the cube attenuation rate. So pure Earth mode ranges quite limited, but a military was able to reach the distance of hundreds of miles, and some of the ham radio amateurs reported between 5.6 miles and a little bit up than that. So which would say that the average was about 20 miles radius, which is 40 miles in diameter. Okay. So the reason I'm a little bit disagreeing with the description of that communication is because based on the modern experience with communication on using the Earth-Air interface, we have a quite different phenomena, and it is much more explained. That is also in regards to article that I have in here that is talking for ham radio communication at those at this mode between two stations. That is mentioning Gobow and Summerfield. But I'm not sure that we have a time for it now, Dr. Roy, and to actually.
Yeah, I think we need to go to the SpaceNet report, but I appreciate your participation. And as I mentioned before, you low frequencies kind of hug the ground. They do travel very far. That's why the Navy was using it up until a few decades ago and didn't quite want to let it go until recently. And amateur radio operators, they call themselves loafers, which I always found interesting because it's rather close to the sound of my last name, Laufer, that I shouldn't be involved in something like that just for the name alone. But it does travel far and wide. But again, my understandings and everything I've read about it have a significant symbol rate problem. So it's an interesting phenomenon to study, but as a practical means of communication, unless you're stuck with that and only that, the rest of the spectrum higher up is far more useful for technology. But I do want to thank you, Wesley, for your participation in bringing it up. And, you know, we can travel back to this some later episode, but I just want Paul to have his time.
Just to support my point, when we were talking about controversy of 70 kilohertz, there is a video that is for the communication that took place by ham radio operators at 17.65 kilohertz. So it must be 70 kilohertz, 17.65 kilohertz. And this one was using a Tesla coil with the ferrite rods inside. And on that video that I have sent you, you can listen to the very fast CW communication. So that would be something that you can... That actually proved that 70 kilohertz is nothing. You can listen to the AM radio. 17, which is 17 kilohertz, you can have a full speed, 20 words per second, CW. And to H.
Satellite 2H.
Yes, Lou.
Right, very quickly. There's a Moroccan AM station. Broadcast station on 171 kilohertz. I'm listening to it now on the internet on an SDR receiver. And of course, there's other stuff lower than that. There's Navy stuff, etc. But that's the lowest AM, like commercial type station that I found on this particular receiver. This is the one in the Netherlands, the big one. Was it Trent or whatever the heck it is? So they're down at 171, and, you know, they're playing music.
Any idea what the bandwidth of the music is?
Yeah, well, I filtered it down to about 4K, 3K. When it was going a little below 3K, it started distorting. And I see it on the waterfall, although the computer's on the other side of the room now, but it might be about 5K.
Okay, that's interesting.
So now think about 9 kilohertz communication and think about that video that I sent you on 17 kilohertz with 20 words per minute CW. And to HGN.
Okay, Wesley, I'll listen to it. I listened to the read the previous article. It's just that when you send me things at the beginning of the technical net, I think the rest of the people listening to the technical net would not be happy to hear that I was watching a YouTube while it was going on.
Yeah, Dr. Roy, I apologize for it. Don't forget... Andy told me that we're gonna have a hamper soon.
We're gonna have a what? A ham fest?
That is correct, ham fest.
Yeah, I think it's in July, isn't it? The outdoors, either late June or July.
It's June 5, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Now you may very well be quite correct. I didn't write it down, so I don't remember it. Yeah, I hope people are able to go out and enjoy themselves for a change. It's been a rather claustrophobic year and a half out there.
Sunday, June 6th.
Okay, very good. Sunday, June 6th. Put it on your calendar, boys and girls. This is an outdoors ham fest, so does that mean that club members get in free, or do they have to pay?
Club members do get in free. Pre-registration is required simply for contact tracing.
Okay, so that's interesting. So everyone out there, especially the club members, want to make sure that everyone's still around, eyeball QSO, before you know it, June 6th. How about that?
I believe it's 18 and over also.
Oh, yeah, that's a terrible, terrible sign of our times, but yeah, it's in order for insurance purposes, it's 18 years and older. Anyway, thank you very much, Wesley, for your information tonight. Is it all right if I go to Paul now?
Yes, of course. I do thank you very much for the time given to me. The only question I have, think about it for the week. Are we going to go more to that ground communication? So, because we have some very interesting distances, hundreds of miles, and then we have mostly 25 miles, 5.6 miles by ham radio operators using ground mode.
Okay, very likely we will visit this topic again, Wesley. Again, my gut feeling is if the Navy gave it up, the Navy only gives up frequencies it thinks are worthless, which is why we thankfully got 160 meters and 80 and 40 and 20. It was back in the bad old days when the Navy ran the frequencies before the FCC, and they came to the conclusion that everything shorter than 100 and than 200 meters was worthless. So they gave it up. So I don't know, but we'll talk about it. I'll look at the YouTubes. Okay.
Thank you very much again.
Okay, very good. So without any further ado, let's have Paul come and give us the SpaceNet report. WS2N, please.
Hey, C2GS, WS2N. Very good on the net tonight. And I like topics, too. Very well. Anything where you're taking something apart or putting it together, trying to figure out how something works, it's very interesting. Okay, as far as the SpaceNet report goes, news this whole weekend was, where was this Long March 5B rocket going to hit? You know, and all the... No matter what TV station I put on, Channel 12 News, they all picked up on it. And you can tell they all copied it from each other. You know, they had the speed at 18,000 miles an hour. Really, in reality, it's 17,400 miles an hour. But everybody was quoting the same information. They make it look like this whole rocket is coming down. They show it launching from the launch pad, but, you know, the four side boosters get separated. Then there's the core stage, and that's the one that I actually put into orbit that really shouldn't be there. And then above the core stage is the space station itself, the first part of the space station. And they call that the space station. And it's the beginning of a real space station. They've had two of them up there in recent years. First one they put up, they sent crews up to it. It was just one module, and that was a few years back. And that was the one that eventually became uncontrolled and did what this one did, just kind of like found its own place to come through the atmosphere. The second one that went up, they figured out how to control that one, and that deorbited properly over water. Now this third one is the same as, you know, years from now that they'll be able to deorbit this thing properly. The difference is the first two were single modules, and this one is going to be multiple, and this is the first of three. They eventually maybe other ones plan to attach to it, but there's really going to be three big modules for their space station. And, you know, this one got up there successfully. It's got a different inclination than what the International Space Station has. The inclination is, for the space station, like 56 degrees. This one's like 40, I think it's 41.2 or something like that, low 40s. And, you know, that's determined by the launch complex where they launch from usually. When they launch a heavy vehicle like that, they want to put it in one direction, and they'll keep it at the highest inclination that they can possibly have, because as it goes around the Earth, they're able to look at most parts of the Earth. You know, the space station can look at a little bit more because it gets higher in inclination and lower in inclination when you go south of the equator. So, now, you know, it's successfully got up there. And this 100-foot-long booster, by the way, it was fueled by liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So it's a modern booster. I mean, this is their only third launch of the Long March 5B over the last couple of years. And when, you know, the problem is that they're not putting little thrusters on there to reorient it in the proper direction, and then not reigniting the engine to slow itself down to deorbit over the water. They're just, you know, letting it fly. You know, I mean, it's been done before. This thing weighed a little over 20 tons, like 20 small cars, 22 tons. That's the weight of it. I mean, we have them beat, because we had Skylab up there, and we had over three times that amount. It was around 77 tons that came flying down, and parts of it hit Australia. Nobody got hit, but, you know, that was the fault of basically running out of money. We had plans on eventually deorbiting that thing properly, but there was no more money to send any more unmanned spacecraft up to the Skylab to do that. But we've been pretty good after that. You know, we've made our rockets where if there is a stage that goes up, we tend to reverse direction on them and deorbit, have them come through the atmosphere, and usually land in the South Pacific. All these cargo vehicles that go up to the International Space Station. You have Cygnus that's being built by the United States, launched on the Antares rocket. That's a cargo vehicle that burns up over the South Pacific. The Progress vehicle is launched by the Russians. Cargo vehicle also burns up over the South Pacific. And also the Japanese vehicle, that's a very large one. Presently, that sends up like 13,000 pounds of cargo when that goes up. probably three times the amount of Russia's cargo, payload, and just a very large vehicle. Well, that also deorbits and burns up over the Pacific. When the European Space Agency was launching the ATVs, the automatic transfer vehicles, which was even bigger than the Japanese one, they also used to deorbit properly. But not China. I think they're going to get a lot of flack, and they're going to have to do something from the international community. There aren't that many of these launches in the near future. If you watch the news, they say, well, there's going to be 11 more launches for their space station that they're building. Well, there's going to be two more for these other two modules, and then there's going to be other launches, mostly Progress vehicles, like cargo vehicles. And then there's going to be manned vehicles. For instance, in a couple of weeks, they're going to be launching the Long March 7, not the Long March 5B, which is a smaller rocket. And they won't have that problem. Although their boosters and their first stages, they do come down. But their boosters, they think nothing of having these things come down on their own property. They've had people get in China actually get killed by these things, or light little villages on fire when they come flying out of the sky after they launch a rocket. So they're used to that problem. I just don't think that they get it, that the rest of the world is not happy with boosters coming possibly in their direction at ridiculous speeds. So we'll see what happens. The next one going up is going to be a cargo vehicle. It's called the Tianzhou, and Tianzhou will be launched in a couple of weeks. After that, in June, send their first crew up, if all goes well, crew of three, and that'll go up on a different Long March vehicle, a much smaller one, Long March 2F, which they'll be sending a Shenzhou manned spacecraft up. That thing's launched multiple times over the year, since 2003. So they know how to do that. And again, they won't have problems with the boosters. But the news media makes it look like, oh my goodness, we're going to have at least 10 more of these boosters. And it looks like three more, which is, I mean, it's no bargain, but it's a lot better than 10. And I think by the time they plan on extending their space station, putting more larger modules on years from now, maybe 5-10 years from now, by that time I'm sure they'll have a way to deorbit these boosters. Let me drop in for any questions before I go on. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Okay, now back to the U.S. The Starship program, which I've been covering for years, is finally making some decent headway. The SN-15, that's the 15th, supposedly the 15th Starship that Elon Musk at SpaceX has built. Well, that's the number they're giving it to it. For instance, they launched number 8, 9, 10, 11, and they all blew up when they landed. They set them up 6 miles, they brought them down, and they crashed into the pad, except for one actually landed, but then it was on fire, and then sure enough, it blew up, and they had four in a row like that. Now, finally, number 15, by the way, they canceled number 12, 13, and 14. They just didn't need that because that was what he considers the old design. 15 is a new design, so that's why they give this one the number SN-15. They just canceled, 12, 13, and 14. Anyway, SN-15 successfully took off from Texas, Boca Chica, Texas, near Brownsville, Texas, right near the Mexican border. Took off, went up 6 miles, and then came back down. It goes from vertical to horizontal, and it's got these flaps, and the flaps are motorized. And, it's able to control its descent all the way back to where it took off. They built large concrete square landing facility for these things to land. So, you know, it came down, and I noticed this time they did the flip earlier. Usually they get pretty close to the ground, and then these three Raptor engines kick on at one time, and you know, they severely gimbaled, you know, kicked out to one side, and the whole bottom, you know, gets shoved over, and then they quick move the gimbals in the other direction, and they bounce it out, and just at the right time, they're able to come straight down and land on that pad. Well, that's the way it's supposed to work, but, you know, I thought, well, maybe they should do this a little higher, and sure enough, they did. I'm looking to find out if they put more fuel in. I guess they probably did that. They probably, you know, made the tanks a little bit bigger, because they did do the flip earlier. You know, I went up to 6 miles, where, you know, that was the height they were supposed to go to, and then, you know, it came down, and then the three engines reignited much higher up, and then when they came down, they were able, you know, more of a hover type of situation as they were coming down right before they landed. Anyway, it was very successful. It landed properly right on the pad, and which is a good thing. I sent that picture. I sent a picture of the Starship taking off, and I have also a picture of the Starship that had landed. After landing, it did have a small fire coming out on the side. These things are liquid methane engines, liquid oxygen engines, and who knows, maybe they have a small leak, and they'll work on that. The last one had a bigger fire, and I think that's what led to it blowing up and failing. This one, they did very good. In fact, they had water shooting out of it. They're ready for it. They have, you know, water facilities, spray heads, making sure that, you know, they can cool the rocket down. But it worked good, and it should be a good advancement for Elon Musk and his goal to get a crew eventually to Mars. And anyway, you can see that picture on if you go to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs, and scan down, and you'll scroll down, and you know the picture that I sent them actually looks great on his website. You know, I just sent him a small picture on an email. It looks very, very good. And then right below it is a picture of the same rocket after it landed. You can still see the little fire coming out on the side of it near the bottom. So that was successful. I don't know what his plans are next. I don't know if he's going to try relaunching SN-15 again. He's got SN-16 ready to roll out of the hangar. And I'm not sure yet, but I'll report on that next week when they make a decision on what they plan on doing. You know, I think they're going to try SN-15 again and maybe just launch it to a higher altitude. We'll see. Eventually, they're going to have more engines. The Starship version that he has will eventually have 6 engines. It has 3 Raptor engines that they use now. Each one produces almost 500,000 pounds of thrust. And what you think about it is it's almost the equivalent to what he does when he actually launches a Falcon 9 off the launch pad, which is 1.7 million pounds of thrust. This is almost 1.5 million pounds of thrust, just short of that. So it's a lot of power put this massive 30-foot diameter thing into off the ground. The other rockets, Falcon 9s, are 12 feet in diameter, 229 feet tall. This thing's around 167 feet tall. But the goal is to eventually take this whole Starship and put it on top of a booster. You know, this is essentially the second stage. He's developing a booster also down in Texas, which is going to be, you know, by the time you put this 160-foot thing on top of that, you'll be up to a 400-foot level. Also, everything 30-foot diameter. Running on liquid methane, liquid oxygen. And but the booster, instead of course, having three, well, this has three engines. It will eventually have six engines, by the way. The other three engines that will be installed will be, they call them vac engines. They'll be Raptor vac or vacuum engines, which have capability of running in a vacuum. They will eventually have six on this piece that he's been testing for months on end now. But on the booster, he's going to have 28 of these, 500,000-pound thruster engines, Raptor. They call them Raptor engines. 28 to launch this one Starship that he's been tested. That's 167 feet tall. Put that on top of a booster and blast that thing into orbit. The booster itself will turn around and come back to where it took off from. It's going to have enough fuel to do that, and it's going to land and eventually be able to refuel, so you'll be able to reuse the boosters and hopefully reuse these starships. Starships, of course, will eventually be manned. They'll have crew versions, uncrewed versions. Once they're manned, he could theoretically send it to Mars. Anyway, that's years away. We'll talk about that when that happens. I think he's first going to try to get to the moon. NASA's already got a deal with him, a signed contract to participate in the first moon landing since Apollo 17 many decades ago. Okay, any questions? This is WS2M. Okay, Mars, we're already there. We just don't have people there. Two operational rovers riding around on Mars. We have an operational seismometer sitting on Mars also. InSight is still operational. And we have the two rovers, one Curiosity, still working very good, which landed in 2012, still operating. And now, of course, we have Perseverance landed this year, February 18th, which has had Ingenuity attached to the belly of the vehicle. And, of course, that thing is, we talked about that many times, it successfully is flown over and over again. And now on Mars, it flew up to four times, and then just a couple days ago, it flew a fifth time. Each time, they got more and more daring with this. The first four flights, it would go up straight, come back down, maybe turn. It would go up again, move a couple of meters to one side, and come back and land in the same spot. Eventually, they got up to the fourth flight, and they double the speed when it translated to a different direction. And they sent it south, and it went like 450 feet in one direction. And then 450 feet in the other direction, and came back and down and landed. And each time it was increasing the time of the flights. They're getting longer and longer. So because they were so successful on the fifth flight, they said, that's it. We're gonna fly this thing, actually, instead of coming back, we're going to go to a different location. So because they had all the information from the fourth flight, they have this camera, navigation camera looking down, taking 30 shots a second, that information is being fed into its own computer on Ingenuity. It could figure out, where a safe place would be to land. So it found a place around 450 feet downrange. Sure enough, they on the fifth flight took off from, they call it Wright's Brothers Field, took off, went 450 feet south, and came actually went higher, 33 feet into the air at that point, took some nice pictures, color pictures, got a horizontal camera sticking out of the side of Ingenuity, came back down straight, and landed at a newer location. So now it's in a new airfield. Now they've transitioned from, they were supposed to do five, and that's it. They were going to quit after that. That was the deal.
CW go by. Of course, I'd rather listen to CW than listen to me. Naturally, as you can tell, I love CW. So anyway, the new idea from the science team is to use ingenuity to help Perseverance better traverse in the direction that it's going. So they're going to send it ahead all the time. You know, and I don't know how many more flights are left in this thing, but they're going to use it in the future. They're going to make sure they're not going to interfere with the time, you know, that Perseverance is, you know, they're not going to tie it, use of Perseverance, you know, all these vehicles, it's like time sharing, you know. scientists now, they want Perseverance to be dedicated to their science. They want it to go to a certain place, look at the rocks, use their laser beam to heat up the rocks, find out what they're made of, use the core boring machine to eventually leave cache samples all over the planet so that a sample return mission could eventually pick it up and bring it back to Earth. So, they're going to do that, but ingenuity, the team has agreed not to interfere with their time. This way, they're going ahead, but sitting on the side is ingenuity, charging its batteries, getting ready to go, and in the future they'll be able to take another flight, maybe, you know, go into a small crater or look around where Perseverance can't look. Maybe better find a better way of having the rover travel in a certain direction. And so they've actually gone from engineering test system to actual science assistance to the rover. And there's some, you know, nice pictures on a website. If you bring up Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA.gov, and you can see the pictures that they send back. Some of the nice pictures are actually from the mass cam on Perseverance, looking at the Ingenuity helicopter flying. So it's pretty interesting. Any questions or comments for this topic? Okay, so maybe Frank was in there. But another subject is this Starliner flight that Boeing has been trying to get off the ground. They've actually gotten off the ground, but they wanted to get Starliner put into operation. Starliner will eventually be sending crews to the International Space Station. For a long time, they were in competition with Elon Musk with the Crew Dragon, you know, who was going to, you know, get there first. And they were going along fine, but, you know, SpaceX made their first unmanned flight on a crew vehicle to the space station early on. Eventually, Starliner was going to do the same thing. They tried to do it two Decembers ago, and it failed because they had software problems. I mean, it got up into space, it got into orbit. Starliner, you know, its goal is to eventually bring four people at a time to the space station. So naturally, it was unmanned, and they had problems with the software and some other problems as well. I think there was 85 problems they had to fix. But when they saw they had a problem, they knew they didn't have enough fuel left, and they said, let's bring this thing back, and they did, and it successfully landed in White Sands, New Mexico, which is very good. I mean, it's part of the experiment was to, go to the space station, come back and land on land. That part was successful. The only thing they haven't done is dock with the space station with this unmanned vehicle. And they were getting pushed off because of all the vehicles attached to the space station. You know, you need a docking port. And, they were talking about September, and they were talking about August, and then now they're able to push it up a little bit to July 30th.
and then they could dock on July 31st. You know, it just has to do with there's only two ports that you could dock crew vehicles to, and also, one of the docking ports can now also be used by a cargo vehicle. Cargo vehicles all used to be berthed, different setup, with using a robotic arm, and the cargo version of Dragon has changed in the last year. Now they use an autonomous docking system, just like the crew vehicle. But to do it, they have to use the crew docking ports, these pressure mating adapters. There's two of them attached to the space station. Each one has an IDA attached to it, an international docking adapter, and they're the only ones that could accept these crew vehicles. So they need an opening, and apparently they're going to have an opening in July 30th. So hopefully that launches, and that'll launch on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida, docked with the International Space Station. It'll spend days or weeks or attached to the space station. Eventually will undock from the space station. Oh, yeah, when it's attached, by the way, you have a crew of seven up there on the space station. They'll be able to go inside, poke around with on the inside. I'm sure they'll take pictures, send it back to NASA and Boeing. And, but then eventually that Starliner will detach from the space station and fly back to White Sands, New Mexico, where it did last time. And if that's successful, they'll be ready for a crew, which will be great because a few months after that, they'll be able to launch. You'll have Barry Whitmore along with Mike Fink and Nicole Mann. They'll be the three that will launch on the Starliner for the first mission. And they'll dock at the space station, spend probably a couple of months attached, and then eventually deorbit. But then after that, they'll be sending crews of four up. So the idea is eventually to have Starliner, go up, send a crew of four, and then after that, they'll come back and you'll send a Dragon crew vehicle up with four, and you'll be in natural rotation after that, until the end of the life of the space station. And meanwhile, you still have the Russian Soyuz vehicles with a crew of three, constantly rotating every 6 months as well. So generally, you're always going to have seven people, at least seven people on board the space station, which gives them a lot of time to do real science. There's hundreds and hundreds of experiments going on. Daily, during the day, if the astronauts aren't doing it themselves, you have people on the ground that are actually doing the experiments remotely from their respective mission controls, wherever it might be. There's probably a dozen of them around the world, including some colleges. Any questions or comments? WS2M. We have, I was talking about all the space junk and everything up there. You have two missions that have been very successful. One, last February, it was launched, and it was called the Mission Extension Vehicle Program. And what it is Northrop Grumman is doing these missions. They launched the spacecraft, and it rendezvous with a satellite. In the first case, it was a geosynchronous satellite.
That time complete.
That was, really out of fuel, and they had it located in a grave. They call it the graveyard portion of the geosynchronous orbit. So it went out and it docked with this thing. It's got a hook-like thing, and it. The hook extends and goes into the nozzle of the communication satellite that needs to be refueled or brought back to life. That was successful. They did that. And I remember Dick was, K2RIW was fascinated with this topic. He asked a lot of questions. We had a lot of pictures. We sent pictures over to Roy.ac2gs website, you know, of this thing docking with the with this defunct satellite. But because it did, the satellite was able to be brought back to life because now they have plenty of fuel. They're going to use the fuel of this MEV, this mission extension vehicle that was sent up. They'll use that fuel to put the satellite into the proper position, and it can now be functioning again. You know, you got to remember, it probably cost some of these companies like $1 billion to put these satellites up into space. If you could send spacecraft up like a MEV for, you know, maybe, $100 million or more, a little bit more, and dock with the spacecraft, with the satellite, and, you know, give it another life. This first mission is going to give the other one five years life. It's probably had a 15-year lifespan, and I think it got up to around 17 years. Anyway, now it's got another five-year extension. So they sent another one of these things up recently, MEV-2, Mission Extension Vehicle 2. And again, this thing is successfully docked with an operating satellite. I mean, this thing is actually, you know, working when connected to it and docked with it. And now this one is also doing the same thing. It's able to, use its fuel to keep the satellite in the proper location. So I think there's going to be a lot more of these type of missions, which should help for the space junk to some degree. By the way, after these things, after 5 years, they put these spacecraft back in the graveyard location, and then there's so much fuel on these mission extension vehicle spacecraft that they're going to be able to go to another satellite that might not be functioning and continue on. Maybe, you know, add another 5 years to that. Now, they are working on spacecraft that could actually attach themselves to spacecraft, and they have robotic arms on it. And they're going to be able to actually refuel some of these spacecraft that are in space, and some designed to be refueled. They have ways of cutting into it, and they're really getting involved. I think that's going to be on the horizon maybe within a year or so, one of those missions. And all we need is some of these satellites to pick up the space trash that's up there and somehow deorbit that. But, I mean, there are companies involved in that. European Space Agency is one of them. But I think there's going to have to be a concerted effort to try to clean up all the space junk. To listen to the news, they're talking about like a million pieces of stuff that are still up there. You know, might be very small, but anything 10 inches or bigger, you know, anything like 4 inches or bigger are being tracked by satellite, by the United States. We're able to, you know, Space Command track anything 4 inches or larger, which is very important to know where they are. I think they said 20,000 of those things. So, if they can come up with something to gather some of this stuff up, eventually a lot of it, yes, is going to deorbit by itself, but some of it's going to take decades, if not, 100 years to deorbit. So, that's the story. Any questions or comments on the Mission Extension Vehicle Program, WS2N? Okay. Mark Vanderheil. He's an astronaut. He went up with two Russians on a Soyuz vehicle. He's up there now. He's going to be there for 6 months. And sure enough, he's already made a contact with Green Bank Elementary School. He's a ham. He's got a call, KG5 GNP. But of course, when he's up there, they use the call sign for the space station. You know, NA1SS. That's the call sign they really use when they're contacting the school. And I don't think it was a direct contact. I think they used.